The Guardian. I'm Madeline Bunting, and this is Citizen Ethics, a special podcast for Comment is Free. Both the banking crisis and the MP's expenses scandal have left a profound sense of injustice. Was this a failure of individual ethical judgment, or was it something more widespread in a culture in which the winner takes all has become commonplace? What both crises have exposed is how we have neglected the basic ethical questions, such as justice, integrity, and honesty, for a generation. In their place, we've used a language of market efficiency and managerialism. Why have we become so reluctant to discuss the big ethical issues, and can we afford to ignore them? I co-founded the Citizen Ethics Network to provoke a new kind of conversation about what values we regard as important. We brought together three prominent thinkers, all with a keen interest in ethics, for a dialogue here at the British Museum. Diane Coyle is an economist, writer, and former advisor to the Treasury. Michael Sandel is a political philosopher and professor at Harvard University. And finally, Rowan Williams is the Archbishop of Canterbury and a theologian. We asked them to start by setting out their stall. First of all, Michael Sandel.
This event is billed as a public debate. But we don't know whether we're going to have any disagreement or not. So, Madeline, we may be charged with false advertising before it's done. But we'll see. We'll see. I would like to propose two ideas for discussion. One of them has to do with the relation between politics on the one hand and moral and spiritual questions on the other. The second has to do with economics and the need to rethink, redo, renovate economics as a discipline and as a way of thinking. First, about politics and its relation to moral and spiritual questions. It's been common to the theory and also the practice of democratic politics, I think on both sides of the Atlantic, in recent decades, that it's safer, healthier, to keep moral and religious questions at a certain distance from democratic politics. I think the reason for the suspicion of bringing moral and spiritual questions into democratic politics springs from the recognition that we live in pluralist societies, more diverse than at any time in recent memory. People disagree about the good life, the meaning of the good life. People disagree about virtues. And so to bring moral questions into democratic political argument on this view is a recipe for disagreement at least, and at worst, for coercion and oppression and intolerance. Because if at the end of the day democratic societies have to decide what the law should be, and if that decision draws on moral and religious ideas that not everyone may share, isn't there the danger of imposing on some the moral and religious views of others? That's the worry, I think, that lies behind the tendency to try to separate political argument from moral and religious ideals, visions of the good life. So it's understandable, that reluctance, but I think it's mistaken. I think it's mistaken for two reasons. First, on many of the big public questions that we have to decide as democratic societies, it's not possible to be neutral on questions of the good life. And to pretend to a neutrality that can't really be achieved is a recipe for resentment and backlash, which I think we see very often with narrow, intolerant moralisms that try to fill the vacuum that's created insofar as we have a morally emptied or naked public square. It's mistaken the impulse to separate the two for a second reason, and that is that even where it may be possible to decide public questions without reference to moral ideals or conceptions of the good, it may not be desirable. Because the effect is to create an empty, morally empty public space that is vulnerable to being filled by the most intolerant forms of moralism and fundamentalism. So it seems to me we need to reinvigorate democratic political argument by being more hospitable to the moral convictions that citizens actually do care about. We need what might be described as a more faith-friendly form of democratic public discourse. That's my first suggestion. My second suggestion, and it's not altogether unrelated, is that economics has gone wrong as a discipline insofar as it has tried to be, or to claim to be, a neutral science detached from questions of value, detached from normative questions. Back in the days of Adam Smith, even, economics was a subfield of moral and political philosophy. It wasn't a separate subject of study, even, in universities. It was continuous with moral and political philosophy. And the people who did moral and political philosophy also did economics. And so the connection was explicit. Economics has gained enormous prestige in the time, really the two centuries, that it has migrated, separated itself, established or asserted its autonomy with respect to moral and political theory. But that prestige has come at a price. And the price is that it's disconnected itself from the large normative questions that it unavoidably begs. And the connection with the need to renovate economics, to reconnect it to normative concerns, the connection with the first point about reinvigorating democratic politics, I think, is this. Economics and economic public discourse invites us to see ourselves primarily as consumers. An economistic view of politics says that the point of democracy is to give people what they want, collectively where they can't do it through the market. But real democratic debate requires that we see ourselves not just as consumers seeking what we want, but as fellow citizens deliberating about what's worth wanting and deliberating about the common good. So it seems to me the project of reinvigorating democratic politics with a moral vocabulary should go hand in hand with the second project that I'm proposing of recasting economics by reconnecting it with big questions of moral and political philosophy.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ren.
Thank you, Madeline. And thank you very much, Michael, for an introductory statement with which you won't be surprised to hear I'm rather in sympathy. But let me start somewhere else. Let me start with one of the curious euphemisms that we often use these days when we want to talk about moral or ethical questions. We sometimes say of someone or other that their behavior was inappropriate. And that's one of the most condemnatory things you'll ever hear people say in a not very condemnatory society. In particular contexts of activity, shared meaning, we know roughly what we might mean by inappropriate and why we use such language. That's not the rule. That's not according to the rules of this particular sort of activity. But what do we mean when we use such language generally about human behavior? That's not appropriate. Is there a general answer to the question of what is appropriate behavior, not simply in this or that bit of the human world and the human range of activities? Is there appropriate behavior for human beings, or appropriate behavior, better, towards human beings? That's a question which takes us right into the area that Michael this evening and in his book has outlined. And you may ask, why might such a question matter? The question, is there a kind of behavior that is appropriate to exercise towards human beings as such? It's true that you're bound to have a very fierce contest about the answer to such a question. But to ask the question is to open up the possibility that there are things about human beings which are not negotiable, which are not capable of being abolished by this or that fiat of political power, which save us from particular sorts of reductive functionalism and also from particular kinds of tyranny. People who've resisted both functionalism and tyranny have, over the generations, been people who are capable of asking the question, is there something, never mind what the powers that be tell me, is there something that is simply due to human beings as human beings? A religious person would answer, and this particular religious person does answer, by saying that, yes, what is due to human beings is something connected with the notion that they are already, quite before I've got on the scene, connected to the divine. The other person I encounter isn't there just for my sake. The other person is there in their own right. They have a relationship to the creator, to the sacred, however you want to put it, which is there quite independent of me. Therefore, what is due to them is due to the image of God in them, or whatever particular phrase a religious tradition might want to exercise. There are, of course, other kinds of answer. And you'll have noticed that religious people don't necessarily agree on precisely how they're to phrase this or how they're to act upon it. And that's the kind of conflict which is already inscribed as dangerous in the modern mindset, and not surprisingly. But at this stage, I simply want to say it's a question we ought to be able to ask. And we're not able to ask it very intelligently without drawing on some of the resources that religious and ethical and communal traditions provide for us. We're not able to talk about these things without having some arguably normative stories to tell about human beings. Or to put it in rather plainer English, we're not capable of talking about this without some appeal to the people we think of as saints or heroes. Talking about saints and heroes is not terribly fashionable these days in a culture which is instinctively sceptical to the point of cynicism. But this is where I part company with Brecht's famous dictum, that he feels sorry for the society that needs heroes. I see what he means, but I think we have to rediscover something about the notion of the saint or the hero if we're to have narratives that help us say what is appropriate human behavior, what sort of behavior ought to be valued, rewarded, presented as imitable and desirable. And of course, we'll disagree about who those saints and heroes are. But I think we'd be rather the poorer if we didn't have them. The answers provided to the sort of question that I've just outlined are, of course, most effective when they're not abstract, but are bound up with the stories we tell. This is what a life worth living looks like. This is what a life that's desirable to live looks like. This is what a life looks like when lived in a way appropriate to the sort of universe you're in and the sort of relations, religion again, the sort of relations in which that universe stands to its divine and creative context. Disagreeing about narratives, about the stories we tell, the heroes we have, isn't, of course, like a lot of other arguments. It's very difficult indeed to think what on Earth or outside Earth might ever settle it. But the argument matters. And one of the things I valued a great deal in Michael's book was the sense that the argument matters. that if we're not capable somehow of bringing together perceptions about saints and heroes, shorthand for stories of lives well lived, we're not capable of having those arguments of saying, well, this is why I value this story, and drawing out, but this is why I value this story, then somehow we are slipping back into a very managerial, very two-dimensional model of what human society and human enterprise is all about. And I'd want to say, I think, on that score, that one of the things which we've inherited as part of the modern mindset, which perhaps we ought to turn on its head, is the assumption that the default setting of human society and human behavior is neutral, inverted commas, rational discourse, around which are various little Indian reservations for people who have extraordinary and eccentric private convictions, like religious people. You begin with the great rational, classical, open space, the agora of free discussion, and you live with the unhappy fact that some people have convictions marginal to that. I think I'd prefer to turn that around and say the sense of common enterprise and common good is perhaps something that only emerges when you've had the arguments. You don't marginalize or corral the arguments about saints and heroes and life well lived. You have those arguments, and in that process, perhaps you discover the possibilities of goals, visions, and actions that can be owned corporately. Perhaps you discover what is the common good that you can, in fact, own together. I mentioned earlier, Madeline, that coming back from a visit to the Middle East earlier this week and watching what happens to deeply divided religious communities in conditions of stress like Gaza has something to say to this, but that's another story for another occasion. In other words, the space of reasoned political public discourse about the common good is what we create in having the vibrant, lively arguments about who our saints and heroes are. And perhaps it's in that process that we discover an ethic that we can own together as a society.
Thank you, Ren. Diane.
Thank you, Madeline. Well, I think it's up to me to make sure we don't breach the Trade Descriptions Act and have some vigorous debate here. I'd like to start in quite a different way, with some memories of 1985. Almost exactly a quarter of a century ago, the miners' strike was coming to an end. Microsoft had just released the first version of Windows for home computers. Vodafone and Cellnet were marketing the first mobile phones, which weighed in at 20 kilos with their batteries. And it was my first year in a job. I was working at the Treasury. And one of my tasks was to write a report for senior officials and ministers explaining derivatives. Now, this might strike you as unremarkable, because after all, we all wish that senior bankers had understood derivatives. But the point is that the government had already passed the legislation that was deregulating the City of London. The Big Bang, and my goodness, what an appropriate name that turned out to be 20 years later, the Big Bang created the derivatives markets, which just over a year ago helped the banks come within a hair's breadth of destroying the economy. Deregulation was later justified in terms of its economic results, but it was a political project. The government believed in it, and that was why they did it. And my argument tonight is that economics and politics are inseparable, and so are markets and morals. No economic arrangement, including markets, is value-free, and to claim otherwise is actually itself loaded with value judgments. And I also want to go one step further and argue that markets, in fact, strengthen one very important value, namely freedom. Now, economists hardly ever talk about moral values, as Michael was saying. It's not in our day-to-day vocabulary. And the Nobel laureate Bob Lucas tells a story about getting a note from a colleague at the University of Chicago shoved under his office door one day, and he picked up the piece of paper, and it had just an equation written on it. And he writes about it. Normal people would go and ask for some words to explain what the equation meant, but for an economist, an equation is explaining what words mean. So notoriously, we talk about efficiency and we justify markets in practical terms. And there's a good reason for that, because markets are superb at matching buyers and sellers. And the completely decentralized coordination that you get in a complicated modern economy can seem almost miraculous. There's a probably apocryphal story about a Soviet official who visited America in the 1980s and asked who was in charge of supplying bread to New York City, which is amusing because we know that there is nobody in charge. The market provides our daily bread. And, of course, the implosion of the planned economies in 1989 was a dramatic demonstration of the merits of a decentralized market economy in providing material needs. But we all also have a very strong instinct that markets should have limits. And in wartime or times of shortage, rationing, which is another name for central planning, is a norm. Black marketeers meet with social disapproval even as they're doing very good business. And I have here a visual aid, the ration book that my mother-in-law was given in 1973 for buying petrol when OPEC kept us very short of oil. And they look like banknotes, a bit like banknotes. But the difference is that they weren't earned. They were handed out by the government to ensure that everybody had fair shares. To give another example of that kind of instinct, when we think that fairness should trump the market, we don't have a national clothes service, but we do have a national health service. The market's trusted to ensure that we have clothing, but isn't trusted to ensure that people get the medical treatments they need. And looking across the Atlantic at the 30 million Americans who don't have access to medical care, I think we'd all feel very, very comfortable with that judgment. So we should pay careful attention to these instincts about the limits of markets, not only in terms of social justice, but also because they often indicate when markets don't actually work very well in practical terms either. Although not always, the instincts can be wrong. You might think it's a no-brainer that in a time of famine, you should hand out food. But experience in the aid business has shown that if you give out free food, it destroys local farming. The farmers don't have an income, they don't plant again for next year, and it makes the food shortage worse. It's much more effective to give people money and allow a market to emerge in food as the best way to fill stomachs. But efficient outcomes are only one of the good things that we get from markets. And another, the second that I want to get onto, is that market economies allow and encourage innovation. They gave us the computers and the mobile phones. The search for knowledge, which is celebrated in the British Museum's Enlightenment Gallery, is intimately entwined with a search for market opportunities. The Enlightenment and capitalism are close siblings. And the search for knowledge is fueled by a mixture of knowledge for its own sake and knowledge for the sake of making money. Now, particular innovations, they can be good or bad, they can be trivial or important. We can get innovation in weapons and financial derivatives, as well as communications and medicine. We can get a new flavour of breakfast cereal, or we can get a new book from Professor Michael Sandel, which I hope is selling very well in the market. People often talk about economic growth as if it's just creating stuff. But that's wrong. Growth is about expanding knowledge and choice. And choice isn't just consumerism, although it includes that. It's also freedom and individuality. In fact, since about 1980, the amount of stuff composing the British economy hasn't increased. The statisticians weigh it, and the weight of GDP hasn't increased in about 30 years. More than two-thirds of it now is services, which includes culture and museums, but also research into the human genome, or green energy, and hairdressers and financiers and all the rest of it. But without growth and markets and profits, we wouldn't have the prospect of individually tailored cancer drugs. People in Kenya wouldn't have mobile telephones bringing them their first ever access to banking and financial security. And this characteristic of markets as a process of discovery by the people who engage in them is emphasized by Amartya Sen as what he terms capability, an important aspect of social justice. It's a mistake to think about social welfare in terms of the distribution of material things. We also need to include the freedom that people have to shape their own lives and well-being, and freedom itself as an important value. Now, of course, we look for fairness too in society, and I think many of us would agree that the economy at the moment is not fair. But there are unavoidable trade-offs between the things that we want to get out of the economy, the efficiency, the freedom, and the fairness. And it's neither pragmatic nor principled to say that fairness will always trump everything. There is bound to be a constant process of trying to find the right balance, and it's probably impossible to find the right balance. But given that we're off balance now, we're unfair now, what is it about the past couple of decades that has made some people lose all sight of justice and think it's okay to make a profit and that excuses anything? And I think the real market failure is that economic and political power has become concentrated in the hands of an oligarchy. Not just banking, but several other important industries have become highly concentrated. Top executives have gathered so much wealth and economic power that they've turned it into political power, and it seems shackled the political system and continued their ability to pay themselves ever-increasing amounts of money. So there's no question in my mind, no doubt all of yours, that inequality has reached corrosive levels. But if you look at the data presented recently by the National Equality Panel, that's because top incomes have soared so high. And I don't think that's got anything to do with markets. I think that's the exercise of power. Bankers say, as they have during their results season, that they need to incentivize people to work hard and that will help the economic recovery. That's just pure nonsense. In an efficient economy, those outrageous payments would be competed away. The bonus question gets us really right to the heart of tonight's debate, which is about a dessert, who deserves what in the post-crisis economy. And looking outside the Anglo-Saxon world gives us a good example. It shows us that the distribution of resources can be fairer in a very successful market economy. And Scandinavia is my exemplar. They're fairer than us, not because their governments redistribute more money through tax, but because they don't have the outrageous top incomes that we have allowed in this country and in the United States. And they also run their markets better. They're more efficient. Their incomes are higher on average than ours, as well as more evenly distributed. Now, I think it's relatively easy to make the economy fairer. You can use tax and so on to change behaviours. I think it's harder to work out how to make sure we get markets that do embody fairness. And thoughtful observers of capitalism have always asked whether it's bound to eat itself. Is there something about it, the celebration of free choice and efficient outcomes, that means the market undermines its own moral foundations? And I think it can, but I don't think that's inevitable. Almost all economists, and of course you can always get economists who disagree with each other, but I think almost all would say that markets have limits and depend on trust. And we haven't done well recently in maintaining the social norms and the level of trust that would make markets fairer. And that's thanks to the combination of an ideology of free markets masking a reality of completely rigged markets. The marketizing philosophy has certainly damaged the ethos of public service, as Neil was saying in his introduction. I do believe that the use of markets as a tool can improve outcomes in some public services, but only if we never forget that they are public services and that efficiency is only one of the criteria that matter. But in their proper domain, markets give us enormous freedoms and capabilities, and I think that freedom is better than the government, or for that matter, archbishops and philosophy professors telling us what to do.
Oh,
Michael, I just want to kick off the discussion by asking you a question about some of your introductory comments. How can you reassure a predominantly secular electorate in this country that you're not sort of heralding or advocating a form of communalism, or that what you describe about people bringing moral and spiritual issues into the public square is not a way in which religious institutions can seek their own self-interest, which I think is one of the aspects of this which caused such anxiety. I mean, what many people, I think, it would say is that they've seen a lot of religiosity in American politics and they didn't like what they saw.
Right. And I don't like what I've seen in much of that either. But I think the proper response to the intolerant version of religiosity in American politics, I think the proper response is not to try to banish views that may derive from faith traditions, but to create a more expansive arena for moral argument in politics so that the full range of voices, secular and those that may be informed by faith, can have it out in lively, vigorous public argument. I think that actually would be a remedy for the narrow fundamentalist strands that we sometimes hear and that I dislike as much as secularists who would say, let's get rid of it all. I think a better way, a healthier way to address that danger is to have a wider conversation, not one that tries to police the boundaries of public discourse to keep moral arguments and spiritual considerations at a distance.
I mean, I think obviously it's true that people can't cut off part of their identity when they're engaging in public conversations. But the things that worries me as a secular woolly liberal about your proposition is that people who bring religious conviction do have a conviction. They're much more certain about what they think than I am, and they have the power of institutions and organizations behind it. And so your proposition seems to me idealistic, actually, unworkable.
But I think
I think it's idealistic and workable. But go ahead, Ron.
No, I think it's doable because it's been done to some extent. People with powerful and apparently very inflexible convictions sooner or later have to decide who drives the buses, as it were, who actually does the maintenance work for society. What are the things which we agree not to disagree about? And I mentioned the experience of watching something like that emerging in the highly pressured context of certain Middle Eastern environments. I don't think it's impossible. I think the risk is that in a very impatient and short-termist society, you can entertain the fantasy that you might win forever. And that is where I think a religious perspective can be dangerous. I'd grant you that much. Winning forever so that there are never any people who disagree with you. That's a fantasy religious people do, I think, in certain circumstances, play with. But it's not only religious people who do it, because I think there is also a comparable fantasy among some secularists that you could get to the point where nobody ever disagrees with you.
Could I address both of these points? First, to Diane's point, even if moral argument in politics is impossible, even if that's true, it's also unavoidable. Take a handful of issues that have to be decided one way or the other, and that royal contemporary public life, whether abortion should be legally permitted, and if so, under what conditions, whether assisted suicide should be permitted, and if so, under what conditions, whether embryonic stem cell research should be legally permitted, whether same-sex marriage should be recognized by the state or not. Take those four questions that are very much at stake today in politics. Now, one might say religious believers have firm views on those questions, and that leads to dogmatism, and so we want to put those aside. But I would challenge anyone to try to come up with a way of deciding what the law should be on any of those four questions that doesn't presuppose, whether explicitly or surreptitiously, implicitly, some answer or other to big moral and theological questions. And if we can't resolve those questions, even as a matter of law, without implicitly taking a stand, then I think it's better to do it and debate it openly and explicitly rather than to decide these questions as if it's on purely pragmatic grounds, while in effect riding roughshod over the views of some people who think they haven't been heard.
I suppose I think your approach puts a lot of emphasis, a lot of weight on the belief that you can create a consensus.
I don't think that necessarily we can create a consensus. I don't think so. We have to make decisions. And the question is, will we have an open and robust argument? Whether or not, I don't think we're all going to come to agreement. We don't all come to agreement by keeping these questions outside of politics either. The question is whether we suppress the disagreements in the name of neutrality or whether we engage with them openly and directly, knowing that there will be winners and losers, unavoidably. There will never be universal agreement on those questions, I don't suspect.
But I think the question that leaves us with is, what are the vehicles, what are the fora for that disagreement to be constructively handled rather than simply to be a matter of free-for-all public slanging? And I think one of the aspects of what I think of as the classical or republican political tradition is that it privileges not only politics as management, but politics as process, as argumentative process. We have, I think, become captive to a politics as management model, and we've lost, certainly in this country, and I guess elsewhere, a great deal of what we might need to manage those arguments. And I think that's one reason why some people are apprehensive about them. I know you spent the afternoon with London Citizens, and that's an attempt, I think, to do precisely this, to create the fora that are necessary. Yeah. But as I look forward to the general election this year, I ask myself, where are the fora where citizens argue? Not where they are fed bits of party propaganda,
right.
Not where they are whipped up into lathers of populist fury about this or that issue, but where they actually talk to one another. And I don't think there are enough of them.
Can I just add another comment? Mary Warnock, the philosopher, in a piece that we're publishing in The Guardian tomorrow in this Citizen Ethics Theory series, talks about the difference between morality and religion. She says morality has to be part of the public political debate, but that we still struggle to really separate out morality and religion. There's tremendous anxiety about religion, and morality is seen really as actually, in truth, religion. Can you comment a little bit about that? I mean, is it religion that is the predominant issue here, or is it our capacity as moral reasoning creatures that you really are talking about?
Right. Well, it's certainly the second. It's our capacity as moral reasoning creatures, and for that matter, as citizens. I would not draw as sharp a distinction between moral argument in politics and religiously informed argument in politics as some would, because I think the two overlap. I would certainly not say that in order to be moral or to advance a moral argument, one must necessarily be religious. I don't think so. One can appeal to the ideas of Immanuel Kant or John Stuart Mill and make moral arguments in politics without drawing on faith traditions. On the other hand, faith traditions do address some of the big questions of social justice that we debate, so I would not try to draw a sharp distinction. The worry, I think, is dogmatism. And those who would draw that sharp distinction and say morality, yes, religion, no, often hold the view that to bring religion is to bring dogmatic assertion in, and a mere appeal to revelation. And what are we to do with that in a pluralist society? To which I would say dogmatic arguments are not valuable contributions to public discourse, but I would not say that believers have a monopoly on dogmatic views. I think there's plenty of dogma in politics. Some of it comes from religious views. Some of it comes from purely secular views.
Some of it comes from economists.
Well, Diane, I was thinking that, but I was too polite to say that. So
we couldn't possibly comment.
I will acknowledge it.
I was relying on you.
I think that one of the difficulties in the sort of Mary Warnock polarity, as you've put it, is that it seems to suggest that morality is about reasoning, religion is about dogmatic and unexamined belief, whereas in both there's an element that I want to call the imaginative, which actually bridges the two. The notion of moral imagination has always been one that's exercised me, because it's about dealing with, well, back to what I was saying earlier, dealing with the narratives, the images of what human life might be like, in which, of course, religion plays a major but not an exclusive part. Moral reasoning, with due respect to Immanuel Kant, is not simply about abstract argument. It is about imagining what's possible And that's where I think I'd want to quarrel a bit with too sharp a distinction there.
I'd still like to keep religion out of it. I think we have plenty of religion in public life, actually. And the trouble with it is that it makes people think that morality has its specific subject matters or domain, that it's about discussing abortion or marriage. And actually, I'd rather have morality in a discussion of economics than religion in a discussion about marriage.
Well, I would like all of the above. And debates about social justice, or debates about just and unjust war, which is a very important domain of public discourse that's really gone under-addressed in recent years, those questions, the economy and of just war theory, have been powerfully informed traditionally by various faith traditions, not just or only asserting dogma, but I'll take the tradition of just war theory that the Catholic Church has offered, which is a tradition of moral reasoning informed by a faith tradition that can be very illuminating in contemporary debates alongside secular views about what counts as a just war or an unjust war. Likewise, debates about the justice and injustice of various aspects of the market economy. So I agree with you, it's a mistake to sequester social and cultural issues and label them moral. I agree. And to consider that economic questions, that's another category altogether. So I share your impulse to bring moral considerations and fairness considerations to bear on economic questions.
It is, of course, reflective of the fact that, as Madeline was hinting, the churches tend to get defensive and moralizing about a very small set of public issues, notably issues about personal relationships and sex. And I remember vividly a friend of mine saying some years ago, at an earlier time of financial crisis, that he'd been going to confession for all his adult life, and he'd regularly been asked questions and sort of tested out on issues around personal relationships, but he said he'd never been asked a question about his use of money. And he thought that was a grave failing, and I agree.
Could I put a question to you?
Yeah.
Just a quick challenge now, too. Since Diane and I have gently gone back and forth, a question, harkening back, Madeline, to your point about an excess of religiosity in the U.S., and what is that? Should that lead us to be wary? Here's a question, and I don't know the answer to it, so it's not quite a challenge, but a question. I have a hunch that it's easier to have a robust engagement with competing moral and religious views in democratic politics in a society of the kind I'm most familiar with that doesn't have an established church. Do you think that's true?
No. But to give what I hope isn't an evasive answer, it does depend a bit what you mean by an established church. because...
Perhaps we can think of an example.
it'll come to me in a minute. What I mean is that there is a legacy, which is part of the history of this country, of an established church being, well, as Neil was saying at the beginning, that the church which is allowed to set the bar for public involvement, election to Parliament, membership of the British Museum's committees, a confessional state with a church which is approved. We were there until the 1820s. The 19th century actually saw a steady erosion of that notion of confessional state in the UK, and I think that erosion has gone on. What we now have is a very eccentric relic of that history. I'm not talking about myself. I'm talking about the Church of England. The Church of England more broadly. Comment is free. Coin a phrase. And it was expressed by one of my former colleagues who said, the Church of England is the shadow of an established church. Mm-hmm. And in a bizarre way, as such, it allows perhaps more discussion, more exchange on these matters than you might otherwise find. Because what it says is, this is a state part of whose history is taking religion seriously in public, but a state that has stepped back from endorsing this or that religious policy in public. Within that space, a certain amount can happen. And I suppose that's why some of my Muslim and Jewish friends say, for goodness sake, hold on to the establishment of the Church of England, because it allows us to be taken more seriously than we might otherwise be in the public sphere. So not a wholly straightforward question or answer.
Before we come to the audience, I feel duty-bound, because somebody in the audience will certainly raise this point, which is that I don't think we've really addressed the question of the debate, and I wondered if perhaps you could... we've drifted a little bit, and yes. I wondered maybe if, okay. if you could each just address yourselves very specifically to the question. Perhaps Diane, you did, but right. but Michael and Sarah.
Okay. Well, who deserves what and why? That's the first question of justice. And we ask this question, and we gather here in the wake of the financial crisis and public outrage over bankers' bonuses. I think that outrage is morally interesting because outrage is a special kind of anger. It's anger at what one takes to be injustice, people getting something they don't deserve. That separates it from garden variety anger. And why is it felt by many people that the bankers don't deserve the bonuses? The easy answer is they've been the beneficiaries of public bailouts. Why should they get this money? But the harder question and the more far-reaching question is, all right, that's a special case. Let's put that aside. The huge differences between banker and CEO pay in normal times, by comparison with the earnings, let's say, of nurses and school teachers, are those justified? Would we say that under those conditions, bankers and CEOs morally deserve to make, say, 300 times? In the U.S., the ratio of CEO pay to that of the average worker is about 340-1. Is that justified? Never mind the fact that there are public funds put into these institutions. I think that's a question that should be more central to our politics. And the real challenge is, will the debate over the bankers' bonuses in the wake of the bailouts feed into that broader question, or will it be seen as a special case?
Rowan, do you want to tackle the question?
One of the things I valued in Diane's presentation was the underlining of the fact that disproportionately high financial rewards in the financial industry were not necessary to the market principle or to competition. And yet that is still brought out as a justification for those disproportionate salaries and the immense inequalities that are produced. It's as if that particular bit of our common life is allowed to lose touch completely with the notion of fair reward. The worth of what is being done is nowhere in that equation. And I think what Michael's been saying is that the way in which we reward, and I'll use the example because it's, I think, the most outrageous one, the way in which we reward or fail to reward the teaching profession, not only financially but in terms of public status, is one of the most deeply depressing and disgraceful things about the society we're in, because it indicates that we actually do not see the induction of the next generation into civic virtue and knowledge and capacity as something we want to reward. We want to signal that we value. And that to me is the problem about inequality here. There, on the one hand, you have the issue of work which is manifestly constructive towards the common good and measurably so. And on the other hand, you have, as I say, a world in which there seems no longer to be any connection at all between the worth of what's done and the rewards that are offered. And the argument is phrased solely in terms of competitiveness and incentive, in ways which actually, if you're right, Helen, I think you are, have no economic foundation.
Mm-hmm. Diana, I just wondered if you could perhaps also kind of tackle the question, can you have justice in one country? In the sense that if Rowan and Michael's suggestions are put into policy and there's a massive expansion of the public sector pay levels and banking in the city is brought down to a much lower level of pay, and the bankers all leave and go off to Geneva and Hong Kong and the financial sector is ruined. Do you see my point about, is it possible in a global economy to actually set a course which is much more equitable?
Oh, I think it certainly is. The global economy complicates things in other ways because we start worrying about the well-being of other groups of people, so poor people in developing countries we worry about now, and I think we wouldn't have worried about a generation ago. So that takes you to questions about immigration and how much of that should be allowed and so on. So that complicates things. But the idea that the economy would be torpedoed because we're not paying bankers enough, I think, is just ludicrous. Mm. There are lots of other... We overestimate the importance of the financial sector. The creative and media sector, which includes the British Museum, is more important in GDP than finance. So we place far too much weight on it. I think it's harder to answer the question positively than negatively. There are certainly people who are getting things that they don't deserve. And I think you could probably even come up with a number for the distribution of incomes that beyond which greater inequality corrodes the economy in terms of efficiency as well. I think it is actively destructive of economic well-being. And I would add one caution, which is that we shouldn't only think about people getting what they deserve in terms of money. It's not just a question of materialism. The status matters too, the inherent enjoyment that people get out of their works. Mm-hmm. And so I would start from the market as the place to work things out, take account of the non-material benefits that people get as well, and say, you know what, 400 times salary, the average salary, is just too much.
And by American standards, you're too sensible to count as a proper economist for purposes of the debate.
I'll take that as praise.
You've been incredibly patient. I don't know if you agree with me, but the conversation on the panel was so interesting that I didn't want to stop it. But if you have comments or questions, keep the comments brief, but please put your hand up and microphones will be appearing. What I'll do is, if it's all right with the panel, we'll take a few questions in a group. So there's a gentleman right at the back. I think you've got a microphone just to your side. And then if a microphone could come down, there's a cluster of hands waving in this bottom corner here.
My name is Sam Dickson from the British Humanist Association. And I just wanted to make two very brief comments. The first is that although I realise that the pamphlet which you're contributing was precipitated by this economic and political crisis, I wanted to disagree with the idea that Professor Sandel raised about morality being currently absent or sidelined from political debate, and one of the points that the Archbishop of Canterbury raised about, for example, heroes being unfashionable, because I don't see that as being the current situation at all. And although I think that there are political problems ethically, and politicians don't always behave as I would wish them to in terms of what ideals they pursue, I don't think that the absence of moral discussion and moral consideration in politics is one of them. And we just need to look at some of the debates in Parliament over the last 5 years about the limits on abortion, all those issues you raised with debates in Parliament, you know, debated often morally very seriously, with some people talking about issues of freedom and autonomy, some people talking about the sacredness or otherwise of human life. All that discussion was happening and is happening. And you can hardly listen to a television programme or a radio programme or pick up a paper in any given year without finding a list of national failures or greatest Britons or heroes, and from that to the award ceremonies hosted by a tabloid newspapers about everyday heroes. So I also disagree with the idea of moral figures, figures whose lives are worthy of our admiration and emulation as happy for society as well. And I guess it's because of all that and my perceiving that there is morality in our public life and that these things are being serious issues. But when I hear arguments that there isn't, I think they're proxies for arguments that there should be more religious in Britain to public life. And I absolutely could have been the person to ask the question that you are stressing on that. Isn't that just a sort of Trojan horse? And so I'd be interested in sort of a response on that. And the second thing is that if that's not permitted on.
Okay, thanks.
That's great. Are you okay remembering before we get... And there was a few hands here. There's a gentleman right at the end, and then also in the front row, and then a gentleman behind in a grey jacket.
My name's Giles Goddard. I'd like to add a question to the beginning of the question, or rather to the subject for today, which is who decides who deserves what? I think there's a real question about the place of authority in these kind of discussions now. Until fairly recently, we did have archbishops telling us what to do, and I think it's a good thing we don't anymore, and I speak as an Anglican priest. Hi, Rowan. But what replaces that? Do we deal with... I mean, is the democracy the place of authority about ethical questions, or is it London citizens, and who justifies the position of London citizens? Where do we go? How do we decide who can make these decisions? How do we decide who decides which banker is earning too much?
There was a gentleman in a white shirt, and then another gentleman behind him.
But I have a question for Diane Coyle. You mentioned bankers' pay being very high, and you said that's that was sort of the result of inefficiencies in the economy was the point that you made. I wondered about what do you think is the cause of those inefficiencies, and why does it happen that people get paid 400 times more than other people? I realise it's a big question, but yeah, sorry.
Okay. Can you pass the mic to the gentleman behind?
Yes, I'd just like to come back to what I regarded as perhaps Diana Coyle's slightly dismissive answer to Madeleine Bunting's last question, which I think was a very important one, which is the global dimension of all this, of so many issues now. I mean, I heard somebody, an academic, recently sum it up as we have global problems and we are having national responses, and that is the big problem. And we've seen it with the G20, the chairman of the World Bank describes as too big to be effective, but talks about international regulation, but has produced very little so far, so that even Joseph Stiglitz is despairing and calling for national responses. We saw it with the fiasco at Copenhagen. I don't think I really have to say any more. And, of course, we're seeing it at the moment in the Eurozone with a very strong reaction in Germany to the possibility of Germany maybe having to bail out Greece. So we're seeing a series of national responses when so many of these issues are global. And it's very difficult, I think, to translate those ethics into international ethics. And in terms of financial regulation and limits in the market, Mrs. Coyle, it really has to be an international response to be effective.
And there's a gentleman in the middle of the front row here. Get a microphone, no, right in the middle. If you could put your hand up, yeah.
Well, two quick comments. One, we were just talking about the bankers and who deserves what. And I think there is a serious mistake being made here in trying to reduce the concept of justice to the question of who deserves. Because once you talk in terms of who deserves, one is thinking of an individualist theory of justice, where individuals are sources of claims, either in terms of what they have done or their skills or whatever. Now, I can think of gross inequality, which we would want to attack, not in terms of whether those who are earning more deserve that or not, but rather in terms of whether inequality is a good thing, whether it promotes common good, whether it doesn't create a society in which people are so far apart from each other that they share nothing in common, and therefore no common life is possible. So one can attack vast inequalities of income, not in terms of who deserves, but rather in terms of whether it conduces to common good. If you like, you could contrast individualist theory of justice, where it is reduced to who deserves what, as opposed to a communitarian or a common good-oriented theory of justice, which bypasses the notion of desert altogether. The other point is about what we were discussing earlier, about all political questions having a moral dimension. I don't think anybody would want to deny that. Michael is therefore right to say that there has to be a robust political debate, robust debate between different points of view. I think the important thing here is as follows. You can have moral positions being robustly debated in political life. At the end of the day, people wouldn't be able to persuade each other. We can discover a common ground, but a point would be reached when serious moral differences cannot be resolved. The question then is, what do we do? And I think what generally happens is, A, there are certain ground rules, call them moral principles, which are universal. human rights or whatever, which regulate different ethical traditions. And secondly, we then say in the course of argument, look, I do understand what it is you are saying. I can see that it is a morally permissible position, although it is not the position that I would wish to take. I mean, I can think of debates in the House of Lords on the recent equality bill, where the church is wanted exemption from the human rights argument, saying, you know, we will not want to employ people or extend equality to people who are gay or whatever. Now, if you look at how the debate was resolved, arguments were advanced on both sides. Each was able to appreciate what the other was doing, but nevertheless, there was no conclusive persuasion on either side. And finally, each people said, look, I do understand where you are going. I think this is the minimal common ground on which we can agree. And if a group is prepared to settle for that, robust debate is possible. If a group is not prepared to settle for that, and I can think of religions, you see, the religion that we have been talking about are those who have been living within democratic society for several years. If you have religions which have had no such experience, if you like, which have not undergone reformation, you have really difficult situations, and they can't be dealt with in the same way that Michael or Archbishop were saying earlier.
Thank you. So, actually, there's too much morality. It's all over the place. Why are you coming and telling us that we need more of it?
Right. Well, I agree that we hear a lot about morality in politics when questions of sexual morality and end-of-life, right-to-life questions arise. I agree. We do have some moral discourse in politics about those issues. But what I would suggest, and I think this is in line with what Diane was calling for, is that we expand what counts as a subject in need of moral argument in politics to include economic questions and to include questions about where markets should govern and where they shouldn't go, and including also questions about pay differentials and distributive justice. So that really, I think, is where we have not had a robust engagement with the underlying moral questions. As for heroes, the prevalence of heroes, I think we tend to confuse heroes these days with celebrities. And I don't think that's the kind of thing that Rowan had in mind, and I sympathize with his emphasis on that. As for moral desert, maybe not being relevant after all unless you are an ardent individualist in your approach to justice, Bhikkhu's point, I don't think Bhikkhu would accuse me of being an ardent individualist in regard to justice.
I should add that the title actually is the title of one of your chapters in your book, isn't it? So yes. For communitarian, it's just a curious turn of phrase, I agree.
Well, here's why I think it's an unavoidable question. There are those... Now, my own view is that the distribution of reward, monetary reward, but also, as Rowan and Diane were both emphasizing, recognition, honor, esteem, which is closely connected in market societies to monetary rewards, that those rewards, whether of money or of honor and recognition, should be in proportion to one's contribution to the common good. But in a market society, the idea easily takes hold that whatever distributions of income and wealth and honor markets produce is just because people deserve the benefits that flow from the exercise of their talents. So in order even to get to the idea that distribution should match contribution to the common good, one has to grapple, I think, with the claim, and it's a claim that's powerfully rooted in our intuitions in market societies, that some moral desert attaches to the results that flow from the exercise of one's talents in a market society. I think ultimately that claim of moral desert fails. But that argument has first to be made. We have to ask the question of moral desert, even to get, as I would like to get, to the alternative picture that responds to the common good.
Diane, there was a specific question for you.
Yes, there are a couple of specific ones I'd like to pick up on. One was about the global dimension, and I didn't mean to be dismissive about it, so let me just expand a bit more on that. There are some bits of dealing with the crisis that need a global response. Banks are multinationals, and they can move their capital around, so capital requirements need to be set internationally. And actually, on the things where that kind of coordination is needed, we have it, and capital requirements are being increased around the globe. There are other areas where there isn't global agreement, and what to do about bonuses is one of them. Copenhagen is another very good example. I don't think they all need to be settled at international level. If they fail, there are things that national governments can do as well. So take climate change. If the international agreement failed, I think it's absolutely right and proper, morally correct, for national governments to decide that they will carry on and tackle the problem themselves anyway. They don't need to wait for an international agreement to do it. On bonuses, the counter-argument is that all the bankers who want to be paid a high bonus will move to New York or Hong Kong. Well, that's fine with me. Let them go. They will take their risk-taking with them, and they weren't adding value to the economy. It's not going to be a great loss to the British economy. The British economy will do other things, and it will grow in much more valuable activities. So I didn't mean to dismiss the global issue, but I think it's overemphasized. If you look at the distribution of income in different countries, you get a huge array of patterns, and that tells me that there are not global laws operating, that distribution is a question of political outcomes in individual countries, and between Brazil and China and Norway and the UK and US, they differ incredibly because of different political outcomes. And the bankers got away with it here because of politics, because it's a concentrated, uncompetitive industry. They make donations to political parties. They use their wealth to exercise influence over financial regulators who are paid much less than bankers. And that's how they got away with it, I think. And we should tackle the lack of competition, just like Rockefeller was tackled in the 1920s in the US. We need trust busting.
Ryan.
Yes, a couple of specifics, if I may. Just to pick up that last point, though. Do we have to wait for a global consensus before any difference can be made? I agree, no, we don't. And one of the areas in which that is, I think, going to be very much discussed in the months ahead is as the campaign for what's being called a Robin Hood tax, that is a tax on a financial transaction, as that campaign gathers momentum, which I think it probably will.
It's a very bad idea. I'll tell you why later.
But
you're against the Tobin tax? You're against it?
I'll stick with it for the moment. And not having heard the explanation. It's I think argued quite effectively that could happen in one country without necessarily needing international consensus. It would be something which, it is said, it would be right to do, whether or not everybody would do it, and it would be possible to make a difference financially even within one country. But that's an example, obviously contested, of something which might not have to wait. There are doubtless others, and some which you would think are better. But let me take a couple of others, if I may. I'm going to go back to the first question. I think Michael's probably answered it as I would want to, that I take the point that it can sound as though moral issues are banging around in the public sphere quite a lot because of the noise that certain kinds of activists make. I want also to flag up the silence of what I would regard as proper moral consideration in some other areas, debates about migration, about investment, about the funding of education, which are moral issues at bottom, and we need to draw out why they're moral issues. And we're not very good at that, I think. I don't think that expressing an anxiety about that is just a proxy for feeling there's a lack of religious input. I agree that there's quite a lot of quite audible religious input, often in areas which are not the best places to put it or the most effective. And, well, I think I'll leave it there, but that's the point. And the catalogues of everyday heroes and so forth, they're not insignificant, and you're quite right to point that out. What I miss, though, is the sense that, as opposed simply to rewarding or celebrating the odd act of spectacular virtue, we don't seem to have very many protracted stories, lives that we look at. We've sometimes used that corruptly and badly in the past, but we may still need to go back to it. And I often quote in that connection a conversation I had in South Africa about 25 years ago with somebody who said, a white woman very much involved in the Black Sash movement in Johannesburg, who said, the trouble with this country is that the people who our children ought to be taught to regard as heroes are all in jail, and the people they're taught to regard as heroes ought to be in jail. Quick word about two other matters. Bhikkhu's point in the last question, what happens when disagreements are irresoluble? Yes, that's exactly the point, I think, where having aired the disagreement, you have to settle with, granted there are winners and losers, you have to settle with some arrangement you can all recognize as representing something, even if it's far less than ideal. And I think there is an issue about, as I hinted earlier, that particular dimension of religious belief, not just the preserve of any one faith, which does think the ideal is to have no opposition. The ideal is to end discussion forever, with everybody agreeing. That is the difficulty. I think that it's only the experience of complex and plural societies that can, as it were, educate towards doing better on that. And last, Giles's question about who decides who deserves what and what justifies the decisions. Well, I don't think we have a sort of national moral authority that can do that. As you say, archbishops no longer do that sort of thing, though I hope they may be allowed to ask awkward questions even though they don't give all the answers. I think that has to be, again, part of how we imagine and configure an argumentative and debating process, how we understand what legitimate political institutions look like in terms of decision-making. And that's a very pragmatic answer, because I don't think we can run a whole complex society on revelation or pyramidal authority.
I'm going to take some more questions from the audience. I just want to give people a chance to get their hands up. There's somebody over there next to a microphone, so maybe we'll take them first. And there's a couple at the back. There's a gentleman right at the back and a lady two rows down. We'll try and take a few. I think we're going to...
Hi there. My name is Josh Downer. I was a student at Harvard and took your class in bioethics, actually, Professor Sandel. So it's good to see you here. And I'm a grad student at the LSE right now. I wanted to focus in, because I'm writing my dissertation on the sort of international negotiation, the financial response in terms of regulation to the crisis. And I wanted to zero into this idea, what you talked about, trust busting, and the idea that what happened was a result of wealthy people who gained a lot more power and did something that was in their own interest, as opposed to ostensibly what they were supposed to be doing, which is contributing to overall welfare, contributing to the common good, et cetera. But despite the bailouts, liquidity is still dry. They're not providing that function despite making all this money. They're publicly bailed out. And the fact that regulation is still not, they're still falling back on these debunked arguments, which you have, I think, rightly dismissed in terms of, oh, they'll flee and we'll lose the tax revenue from breaking down the banks, et cetera, et cetera. Can we agree, since this public forum is ostensibly about this, that the people who are using their money and their power to prevent governments from regulating effectively what they do and how they operate, is that these people are bad, they should be dismissed from the Treasury of the United States, they should not be listened to in the New York Times, and they should be put aside, and something should change?
Okay, there was a couple of people at the back. Perhaps you could make your questions short, because it's good to get as many questions in as possible.
Yeah.
Yes, sorry. Okay, there was a lady, I think, two rows down from you. If you could just pass the microphone down to her.
Well, I first have to say that I agree entirely, along with a lot of the audience, that teachers should be paid more. But having said that, I think how radical would it be for the public sector to significantly increase teachers' pay? And we really think this debate would get that rolling. I can't see it.
Right, there's some questions down here. There's a gentleman at the front, and then if you could afterwards pass the microphone back about four rows, that would be great. There's two people in the rows behind you.
Picking up the question of teachers and so on, I also want to raise the issue of universities, because the Agora in Athens was surrounded by temples and the academy, and it's in the universities that we try to have our values and so on put on, and yet it's the moment. It's the universities which are getting the swinging cuts to be able to fund bankers' bonuses, as I'm the Dean of King's College London, and we're being forced to lay off hundreds of staff at the moment. And the important thing about establishment that's come up here is actually how establishment is used. What we heard from Neil McGregor at the start of tonight was the end of the Church of England's use of the establishment as lockout to prevent other people and moving into that shadow period of trying to hold the door open. Sometimes we have the problem now with the secular establishment that there's a similar lockout, the attempt to prevent the religious questions coming in. For instance, the comment you made, Madeline, about the secular majority, when actually the national census makes it quite clear that over 70% of this country still claim to be Christian, or your suggestion that religious people are all very dogmatic and assertive when the most dogmatic and assertive people around at the moment or the new atheists like Richard Dawkins. Now, whichever is in charge of the establishment, it must hold the door open. That's why the chief rabbi defends the establishment as a means of holding the door open for these questions. And allowing the religious debate to take part within universities and within the society is vital and not just about sexual morality. Speaking as a biblical scholar and ethicist, Jesus' teachings, four times as many refer to money as referred to any other area of personal morality. And so that's why we need to have that debate that went on in the Agora, and not just let the Agora take over the academy, but actually let the academy, temple, and Agora work together to ask these questions.
Great. If you could pass the microphone back about four rows. There's a gentleman, and then along there's a lady.
Yes, you can hear me. Trust. Diana Coral raised the question of trust. Seems to me you could say there was too much trust, that we didn't really understand what was going on, and that caveat emptor beware was very much neglected. So in a sense, we're all to blame. We just let things go on. We didn't understand, and that was okay.
Thank you. I want to believe in the notion of the common good, but I have a qualm about it, because historically, when philosophers such as Plato and Aristotle transferred their explorations from notions of the individual good life, the individual flourishing life, to notions of a good life for a state, a common good, they at the very least laid themselves open to charges of authoritarianism, paternalism, and possibly totalitarianism. So my question is, can we think up a notion of the common good in which there is still space for individual dignity, autonomy, and rights?
There's a few hands. There's a hand and a supporting hand trying to get them noticed. I don't know if there's a microphone nearby. And then there's two hands at the back, and then we'll probably have to call it a day. The guy's still got his hand up. Yeah, yeah.
Hello. My name's Mark. I'm from the Institute for Global Ethics. I'd like to ask, what is the role of the media
Great. And there was I think there's a lady right at the back with a microphone. Got the microphone, yeah.
I feel like an alienated northerner here from Merseyside. The debate's been very intellectual and very cosy, and it's a debate that certainly matters to me and to most of the people in this country. I think what we want is a healthy society. I feel that the panel have been a little patronising in the sense that they seem to think that morality only belongs to people who think religiously. You listen to any of the ordinary working people in this country, and they have a better sense of morality, I think, than the people who have the power and are governing us sometimes. So a healthy society, please. And we're not just bothered about sharing out the wealth. We're sharing about the good things that come to ordinary lives when society is healthy and we care for one another. And sometimes money has to be distributed fairly to meet that.
Okay. So I think if the panel can draw their thoughts to a conclusion, I know it's not easy. Diane, would it be all right to start with you?
Yes, I don't think I can answer all of those.
Yeah, I think you can pick.
I can pick, thank you. I don't think the people who are trying to sort out the economic mess are bad. I think they are perhaps not seeing clearly. If you think about financial regulation, they would see financial regulation as essential to protect consumers. The trouble is that financial regulation has become so complicated that it keeps out new entrants. I've done a lot of work on mobile telephones in developing countries, and one of the exciting innovations is being able to do banking on your mobile phone. It's very difficult in this country to bring that to the kind of people who don't have bank accounts at the moment and are excluded from the possibility of saving safely or carrying out transactions cheaply, because there is a lock on who can access the clearing and payment system. And those are the kinds of monopolies that just haven't been thought about very much because we've not had to think about them at the moment. And I would, I think the authorities are starting to think about it now. I do agree that the time of plenty is the greatest risk because you get the all boats are rising on the rising tide argument. I completely agree about that. And finally, I think there's a really difficult question about distribution because a lot of the jobs that we care about, where we can see the value to society and we don't think they're getting enough money, are in the public sector. And the public sector has spent all the money on not just bankers' bonuses, but the bailouts, and also promises of paying pensions and promises of paying welfare. And most OECD, most rich country governments are bust. So they've got to shrink their public sector. And I think there's just a really huge challenge coming up in the next couple of decades about how to take the money out of things that we don't need to do in the public sector anymore and put it into things that we would all care about. Because the only way, if you have education provided by the state and health provided by the state, the only way to put more money into the people who are working in it, which we, I think, would all agree with, they ought to be highly esteemed and well enough paid, is to have a bigger public sector, is to put it through the public sector. And I think that's going to be an incredible challenge, actually, and I don't know that there's an easy answer to how to do it. Right. I'll stop there.
Perhaps I can pick up a couple here. No, I don't imagine that as a result of tonight the government will suddenly decide to increase pay in the public sector or do something about teachers' remuneration, much as I'd like it to. But as was said earlier by all of us, it isn't just a question about the pay, it's a question about what value we put on that particular activity. And I just think we need to keep pressing on that. We need to keep saying this is one of the most vital jobs in our society. And if better remuneration is the mark of how much we value it, well, good, let's have that, but let's at least work on recognizing what's being done and at least rewarding it in terms of the kind of weight we give to it in our attitudes to teaching, the respect we give. I know it's a vague thing to say, but granted that we're not going to change the financial situation overnight, we can at least keep arguing that. I like the point about there being too much trust around. I thought that was, sadly, rather on the ball, because I think we've all been, saving your presence, Diane, very much intimidated by some sorts of economists who will say, you don't understand economics. And because most of us don't, we sort of shrug or breathe deeply and say, well, all right, we trust you to know about this. I think the whole sense of our confidence in expertise, whether of the financial practitioner or the economic theorist, has been dented in the last year or so, and that's no bad thing. But I understand the point that it's possible to have too much blind trust or trust that comes from a sense of our own powerlessness or ignorance in a situation. The role of the media is something we haven't really touched on, but it does seem to be pertinent, given who's sponsoring this evening. And I think what's being done this evening is a very good use of the media's power and leverage, but also, of course, not something that you find across the board, because there is a characteristic problem about how the media work, not only in this country but globally, which is a 24-hour news cycle driven by the need for novelty and the shortness of focus, which very easily privileges reactions of panic, or induced panic, or fictive panic, and doesn't allow for much sustained analysis. And that's just increasingly the default setting of news communication. The last point is the last question. And I'm sorry that the impression was given that non-religious people don't have moral seriousness. I think that's not something any of us have said, and I think it would be very wrong to say so. I would argue, naturally I'd argue, that moral energy finds its deepest roots in religious conviction, whether people are aware of that or not. But that's a different thing from saying that only religious people have moral conviction. But I'd want us to hold on to the two absolutely luminous phrases that we use there. The healthy society, which is, I would hope, exactly what we've been trying, with limited success probably, to talk about, a healthy society. But also that phrase about the good things that come to ordinary lives. I thought that was a really extraordinary phrase, which I want to hang on to. We can talk so much about rewards, about public morality, about public debate, and forget that there is something very fundamental in a healthy ethics that is precisely about the good things that come to ordinary lives and the celebration of that. And I'm grateful for that.
Michael, I just wondered if you could pick up the question that came from the middle of the audience about a common good. Can it allow for autonomy and plurality? I thought that was an important point.
All right. I would like to address that. I would like quickly to say about the lobbying that's now going on by Wall Street firms and banks that benefited from the bailout and that brought the economy to the brink is objectionable. And I think the fact that these financial firms, investment houses, are able to do it is partly the fault of the way and here I'll speak about the American setting, about the way the Obama Treasury and economic advisors dealt with the financial crisis. There was great wariness about being seen as nationalizing banks. So enormous government funds were given for a bailout with very little accountability being required. At a minimum, one could imagine saying, in proportion to the public equity or share in these investment houses and banks, or insurance giant in the case of AIG, there should be, don't call it nationalization, call it taxpayer representation on the boards of directors in proportion to the public stake. And those boards of directors could instruct management. First of all, they could fire the management if they thought it was in the interest of the public good, but they could also direct management not to devote millions to lobbying against regulatory reform that would prevent that happening again. And I think it's the fault of the administration and the Treasury that they didn't insist on tougher conditions rather than now simply complain about how unseemly it is that these firms are now lobbying against spending millions to try to defeat the regulatory reform. I think that was a lost opportunity. On the question of the common good, doesn't the tradition, the philosophical tradition, Plato and Aristotle, that prizes the common good, doesn't it run the risk of authoritarianism that doesn't respect individual dignity and rights? Well, there is that danger. I don't know that it's a danger that is unique and distinctive to a tradition that argues in the name of the common good. The question is whether it's possible to mount a persuasive philosophical argument for individual rights and respect for human dignity that doesn't rest on a certain conception of the good life. or what, in Rowan's term, is the proper or appropriate way of treating human beings. So the question is whether there is some way of detaching questions of rights from an underlying and contestable account of the good or of the good life. I don't think there is a way of detaching, which is to say that risk, that danger, is a perpetual feature of politics, and we should be alive to it rather than think that there is a neutral or liberal alternative to a politics of the good life that can secure us once and for all against those dangers. And finally, if I could just address the question that was put about whether we should be discussing ethics only in a time of crisis, or whether ethics and public discussion of ethics should be a subject for all seasons, including times of plenty. I think that the moral considerations that each of us in one way or another has said should be brought to bear on economic arrangements, those considerations, we have an occasion to talk about them now because things have gone wrong. And in the history of political philosophy, the greatest political philosophy has been written in times of crisis and ferment, because that's when the fissures and the reveal underlying assumptions and make them available for question. So the best political philosophy is written in times of crisis and turmoil and anxiety and uncertainty. But I think the questioner makes a very powerful point. The moral considerations that we think are brought to the surface now in a time of crisis, if taken seriously, should inform and animate public debate in all times, including especially in times that can too easily be moments of complacency, which is to say good times and times of plenty.
Thank you. Well, I hope you've found this a thought-provoking evening. I certainly have done. We're very, very grateful to the Barry Cadbury Trust and the Joseph Rowntree Charitable Trust, who have funded this entire project, and it's their generosity which enables you to walk away with a copy of this pamphlet, which includes contributions from everybody on the panel, and indeed some of the people that have been in the audience asking questions are also in this pamphlet. So many, many thanks for your fascinating questions, and I would like you to express some appreciation for our terrific panel. Thank you.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.